Mamie ventilée sur ses parents et sur son acné?
Tellement.
Avec ton écoute, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Hi, this is Ruby Cato Atwood from Yamantaka Sonic Titan, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger's Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including Toronto CIUT, Winnipeg CKUW, Montreal CKUT, and Vancouver Co-op Radio, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring more than 60 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Support the community for just $5 a month and get a new release from Between the Lines or Fernwood Publishing at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we ask why media are incorrectly blaming international students for Canada's housing crisis on Red Eye, reckon with ultimate political weirdo Jason Kenney's legacy in Alberta on the Progress Report, and speak out against Canadian support for Israel's genocidal violence against Gaza on the End of Sport. But first, what have you done to help the economy today? We live in a world where growing the economy seems to be everyone's primary concern, nurturing it, jumpstarting it, stimulating it. But what's the economy anyways, and where does it come from? On a classic September 2021 episode of The Alberta Advantage, Calgary's number one podcast explores what's hidden or obscured when we think uncritically about economic thought. Now, here's the show.
Makes no difference where I go.
Is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage.
Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Patrick.
Hello.
Rory.
Hi there.
And Joel.
Hello, hello.
Today, we're going to be talking about something that everyone loves and everyone wants to see succeed. Something that we have really all invested our hopes and dreams in, and something that politicians of every stripe have promised to grow. Yes, we're going to talk about the wonderful thing that supposedly unites us all in common purpose, the economy. Specifically, we are going to talk about how much of the talk about the economy is depoliticized. And depoliticized might kind of sound like this fancy $10 word, but really what it means is that when people talk about the economy, they are often obscuring or erasing politics. To depoliticize something is to wash the politics out of it or to take the politics out of it. And politics, just for your reference, is about, you know, conflict, antagonism, about competing and opposing interests, and how those conflicts play out in our society. And this is really important to talk about because many of the reasons given for why we can't do things that make people's lives better or eliminate needless suffering and death in our society are justified in a very simple form, in a very simple phrase, in a very simple talking point. Because the economy.
We saw it perhaps most recently in the rush to eliminate any pandemic restrictions or the push to hold the Calgary Stampede while the pandemic was still going on. We need to do these things, we're told, because the economy. Sometimes you'll get a more nuanced version of this. It sounds more like because we need to restart or reignite the economy. But what's actually involved with, quote unquote, the economy is not really explored in any depth. And our argument is going to be that talking about the economy obscures or hides a lot. Talking about the economy should really always be done alongside the question, the economy for whom? We know, for example, that Canada's housing market is very hot and housing prices have shot through the roof. People who own housing or real estate have seen their assets expand in value due almost entirely to a big speculative housing bubble. That's the housing economy apparently doing very well, but it obscures a whole range of things, who benefits in this housing economy and at whose expense. Because we live in a specifically capitalist economy, the results of quote unquote good economic performance or the economy doing good are not evenly distributed. That usually means capitalists are doing great and making their profits, but it doesn't mean life is great for anyone else. And the use of economic performance, or, you know, this idea of the economy doing good as code for a sense of general well-being, that really needs to end. So let's examine first how this idea of the economy came to be in the first place.
In pre-capitalist economies, markets were often understood as a potential destabilizing force. If a ship showed up full of crops and you're a local farmer, there's a chance that the crops in that ship, which it's about to dump on your village, will completely sink the price of the crops you've been growing all season. In fact, like prior to the French Revolution in France, much of the crown's role was to ensure stable grain prices to prevent food riots. And one of the things the monarchy did as it was like liberalizing in the late 18th century was to remove a lot of these restrictions to create like a market in grain, which started causing all of these like ups and downs for consumers who got very, very, very mad about it. And this was sort of like one of the contributing factors towards the French Revolution. So there has been very generally always a sense of economic relations embedded within social relations. So David Graeber, for example, talks a lot about this in his book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. So there were notions of a fair price or sort of moral economy of the crowd. There are these obligations and responsibilities of aristocrats towards the populations that they ruled. All of this changes, however, because of the advent of capitalism. Market relations, the economy, this all becomes understood and promoted as a kind of abstract force that no mortals can reckon with. It spurs colonization and exploitation the world over, and we'll sort of explain how these two link a little further. So moving forward to the 19th century, sort of the main object of a lot of 19th century liberal economic policy was to create this idea of a self-regulating capitalist market based on global free trade. This had the effect of kind of creating a socially disembedded economy, which is basically where capitalism is allowed to sort of operate heedless of any of its social consequences. In other words, that the government should not be allowed to intervene because a laissez-faire market is simply the only way the market should operate. And if there are like significant consequences, like say an Irish potato famine or something like that, the market should be allowed to sort all of this out. However, this does actually create a lot of political upheaval because people aren't very happy about having to like starve to death so prices can equalize or reach equilibrium. And a lot of this really happens during the interwar period. So you get like revolutions, you get a huge economic depression, fascism, war, etc. So all of these issues are on the minds of policymakers among the Allied powers in the closing months of the Second World War. They decided that they should create a different and stable economic order that would avoid a lot of these problems. So most of these ideas were hammered out at the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, which created institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. This era is sort of called embedded liberalism, which in contrast to the sort of socially disembedded market, you instead re-embed the market back into society. So what it does is Bretton Woods creates an international framework that preserves global free trade, but it also gives national governments a lot of like latitude to intervene in their domestic economies to accomplish political goals like full employment or a welfare state, which could iron out some of the disparities caused by capitalism. So this is sort of the golden age of capitalism, the post-war consensus. You know, there's many different names you can call it. However, the Bretton Woods system begins to break down in the early 1970s for a lot of sort of complicated reasons that we're not going to quite get into. But this is sort of a key part of the neoliberal turn. But what embedded liberalism illustrates is that even the post-war liberal technocrats understood the importance of retaining some political control over the economy to prevent crisis. But now that international framework means that individual states that deviate from neoliberal policy to serve political goals will be punished. And like in this sense, muscular social democracy that we saw in the post-war period, it doesn't work anymore at a national level because the international framework won't facilitate it. So basically you can try things and the IMF will and the World Bank will essentially punish you through all kinds of like fun, like macroeconomic policy. And of course, all of this, like this change towards this sort of new international framework was presented as a kind of depoliticizing of the economy to, you know, get politics out of it and just simply let the economy work as it should. But really what it does is it prioritizes the interests of global capital over everyone else. And it's a very political question to decide whose interests should be prioritized. And if anything, what this did is it like restricted democratic political influence from huge sectors of society And then if voters decide they want to do something different, they're going to get disciplined by the world market.
What you can hear what Rory's getting at there is that there's like a whole lot of moving parts to this, you know, problem. And one of the things that we have to try and pick up is how this thing called the economy became this kind of objective thing that we talk about. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And we're really influenced today by the work of Timothy Mitchell, who in a couple of books, Rule of Experts and The Carbon Economy, makes the case that the economy is very specifically a creation of the period from around World War II. But before the economy was made, however, Europe, the West, the imperial core, whatever you want to call it, had undergone a transformation that elevated this sort of set of objective scientific universals as the primary way that they were going to know the world. And, you know, this is something that takes place over a fairly long time. Kind of really the big turn starts happening in the 18th century and into the 19th century. And this transformation with the Enlightenment and the emergence of liberalism, capitalist markets, sort of saw Europe remade as this place in their imagination as the place that science was most realized and rationality was most realized. And so to put it another way, Europe became the land of history and historical development. And it had developed from barbarism to an age of science and reason. And the rest of the world, from that point of view, was bound up by tradition, religion, and despotism. And so the modern world came to be defined objectively and scientifically. And so its various components, you know, the things like a public sphere or a private sphere or very specific kinds of property relations, these were things that could now be defined objectively and scientifically. And because they were objective and scientific, they could be made universal, which means that like any good piece of science, it could be picked up and applied elsewhere. It could be replicated. And so, you know, in brief, the practices and processes that had shaped Europe's development were no longer particular or contingent or, you know, based on very specific things occurring in time and in history, but they were in fact universal and in key respects, natural. And so these ideas were at the heart of the creation of all of the modern social sciences. So, you know, modern history, anthropology, sociology, political science, religious studies, and as we'll see, economics. So the intellectual professionalization that occurred in the 19th century, so the creating of modern universities and modern bureaucracies that begins, you know, in the 19th century and really runs through the first half of the 20th century, took like, you know, part of this process of what we could call like the objectification, naturalization, and universalization of these various parts of European society and applying them out to the world. And so this claim to the status of being the scientifically advanced society based on objective universal principles was kind of the main justification Europeans used for extending imperial power over colonies around the world. But at the same time, the colonies became like laboratories for policy experiments for these things. So in the like framework of these empires, they go out and do these experiments in property and the enforcing of markets and the imposition of various forms of cash cropping, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, all of these things sort of shape the wealth of the European economies, who then recycle that into, again, an objective statement of their own like progress and their own advancement, and then use that to dictate to the rest of the world what they should do and how they should behave. And so through all of this, we kind of move to this process where through these highly political sets of relationships, imperial, colonial relationships grounded in war and conquest, and, you know, we'll talk about this a bit more, but we get this creation of this thing, this objective thing called the economy.
So Karl Polanyi really chronicles this idea that the economy emerges as an institutional sphere separate from the rest of society circa the 19th century, although he is quite critical of it. And classical political economy basically kind of theorized that there was this separation of the market system from society because classical political economy was a way of formulating ways of treating things like money, land, labor, as though they were merely commodities. Polanyi also goes on to suggest that kind of treating these things as commodities was one of the things that led to the collapse of European democracies in the First World War, the interwar period, and the Second World War. A take that we're quite partial to on the Alberta Advantage is from a book called Carbon Democracy, which was written by Timothy Mitchell. And in it, one of the things that he points out is, although it's quite common for economists to kind of take as common sense fact that the economy emerges in the 19th century, you know, with the rise of industry and capitalism, etc., Mitchell points out that no political economist of the late 18th or the 19th centuries ever actually refers to the economy. And this is a term that we now take absolutely and completely for granted. And what we mean by the economy now is something that refers to,
that was a highlight from a September 2021 episode of The Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next, the Progress Report from Edmonton-based public interest journalism publisher Progress Alberta has been broadcasting for more than 130 episodes since 2019 with host Duncan Kinney. On a new episode, Big Shiny Takes and The Forgotten Corner co-host, independent journalist Jeremy Appel, joins the show to talk about his new book, Kennyism, Jason Kenney's Pursuit of Power, in a conversation reckoning with the ex-premier and ultimate political weirdo's legacy in Alberta. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
Friends and enemies, welcome to the Progress Report. I am your host, Duncan Kinney, recording here today in Amiskuchi-Muskaigan, otherwise known as Edmonton, Alberta, here in Treaty 6 territory on the banks of the mighty Kasiskasa-Wanasipi, or the North Saskatchewan River. Joining us today is a friend of the show and staff writer at the Progress Report, Jeremy Appel. Jeremy has written a new book and is a published author, which you should all buy and read, called Kennyism, Jason Kenney's Pursuit of Power, published by Dundurn Press. Jeremy, congratulations on writing a whole ass book and being a published author.
Yeah, no, well, I appreciate that its message resonated with you. I do think that not just in Alberta, but in Canada, I mean, we're living in the political reality that Jason Kenney helped shape. And that, yeah, I mean, what we're seeing now with this brutal assault on the rights of transgender Albertans under the guise of parental rights, even though the proposed policy constrains parental rights if they want their kids, if they want to support their children's gender transition, is, I mean, very much something that I would imagine has Jason Kenney's approval and is something he would have done if he was still in power. I think he would have taken it to the next step. Which is, I mean, that, right? I mean, he made it harder for students to create and be in GSAs, and that, I mean, you can draw a direct line from that to the policies in Saskatchewan and New Brunswick, as I've written, Danielle Smith's parental rights policies, right? And I think, unlike Smith, who I don't think actually believes any of this stuff, she just is surrounded by people who do, who have put pressure on her to bring forward this legislation, which in her mind is like a compromise between what Take Back Alberta wants, which is to just like eliminate transgender people completely, and what most people want, which is for trans people to be supported and treated with dignity. I think Kenney actually believes in this in this stuff because of his deeply held religious and political beliefs that there's a natural hierarchy and order to things that can't be upset.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Smith following in the footsteps of Kenney, right, is that, like, you know, the slow degradation of rights and minority rights, of standard of living, of just, like, you know, attacking marginalized and vulnerable people you know, what Kenny did 5 years ago with GSAs is just like the next iteration of that is just going after trans kids, right? There's definitely like, would Kenny have done it? Absolutely. Does he even believe it? I mean, he's certainly much more of a religious fundamentalist than Daniel Smith is. And, you know, your book goes into his own kind of self-radicalization. The one thing about Jason Kenny is that he is a weirdo. He is a strange person. And that the fact that this weirdo was so politically influential is bad. And it sucks that we have to live in his shadow. But here we are, you know, we get to kind of reckon with it, you know, examine how we got to the place that we're in. And no, I don't think this attack on trans kids from the UCP and Take Back Alberta, Daniel Smith, happens without Jason Kenney as premier first. What were the like weirdest corners that you kind of went down kind of writing this book?
Well, just Kenny's conversion to Catholicism, that was really weird. He was baptized Anglican. His family, as so far as I could tell, wasn't particularly religious. But he was sort of always enamored by the Vatican, which I think is important as this sort of empty symbol of authority that you can sort of place whatever sort of values you want in it. Of course, the Catholic Church has its own teachings, but I mean, Kenny is more Catholic certainly than the current Pope, right? And, you know, his former roommate at St. Michael's University School in Victoria, this sort of posh prep school that his parents sent him to and where he spent the first 2 years of high school. What his former roommate told me he remembers vividly, like Kenny getting up in the middle of the night to actually go see the Queen. It wasn't the Pope, although the Pope also visited later, and he was super hyped about that. But he woke up in the middle of the night to sort of get a good spot to see the Queen at the legislature in Victoria. So this sort of crown fetishism, I thought, is really weird. And then, of course, it comes full circle at the end of his political career when he off to the UK to
pay his respects.
To pay his respects to the Queen, to stand in line. And he's doing like news interviews from the queue, right? And you could tell, I think it was an interview on Global or CTV, but you could tell the host was like really like practically laughing at him, right? Like, what are you doing here? And Kenny was like, well, you know, I'm doing my job as premier, but I thought I should pay my respects to the Queen because it's like losing a relative, right? And then in terms with the Vatican, so when in his first year at University of San Francisco, which is a private Catholic university, right? San Francisco State is the public one. He writes this op-ed in the student paper there, the Foghorn, after the Pope's visit there, that as a non-Catholic, this is before he'd converted, he was appalled that there are Catholics on campus, or people who call themselves Catholic, who don't take the Vatican's teachings seriously, and that this offends him as someone who's not Catholic but admires
just Catholic. A weirdo. I mean, yeah, he's just a weird guy with this like weird, you know, fundamentalist Catholicism and monarchism kind of animating his politics, kind of underneath all his politics. And yeah, like if you were a monarchist in 2024, you are a weird person. And
yeah,
Jason Kenney said that out loud to the public. And just
unapologetic free.
All of this to say Jason Kenney's a freak and a weirdo, and also has been incredibly influential. And I appreciate the psychic damage that you took on to write, you know, what is this, like a 400, 300, 250 300. Page book, 300-page book about
315 pages on the dot. Right.
Yeah,
that includes like the index and footnotes, and so yeah, I think the book itself is like I don't know, 280 pages.
Yeah, there's a prologue and a foreword, which I like had pointed out.
Yeah, foreword from Dave Klayman-Haga, who I think does a really good job saying like explicitly that Jason Kenney is a weirdo.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does. He comes right out. I think he quotes Sean Spear. No, he doesn't quote Sean Spear, but I think he does.
No, I quote Sean Spear. Sean Spear would never say Kenny's a weirdo. because to a guy like Sean Spear, and you know what? That retrospective interview Kenny did with the Hub after Smith was elected leader of the UCP was very helpful, because of course Kenny wouldn't talk to me for this book. So that was helpful very much in sort of having journalists who got access to him so I could get a sense of sort of what he thinks his legacy is. And I mean, Sean Spear called him, you know, one of the most influential conservative politicians of the past 30 years. And I think that is spot on. And I mean, Sean Spear would know, right? I mean, he is a total conservative insider hack. But I don't think he was engaging in hyperbole there. And then there are other two, right? You know, Steve Paikin had a book in the early 2000s called The Life, where he just interviews essentially like career politicians and talks about how cool they are and interesting they are. And yeah, it's of course it's cringe, but there was some useful information in there from Kenny just about his like background in life that I kind of was able to weave into the narrative. And of course, in true Paikin form, everything Kenny says, he just takes at face value and doesn't like critically interrogate it at all. But that allowed me to do so, right? Having that as a sort of primary source. And then, you know, like Paul Wells as well, in his book on Harper, there's some good stuff from Kenny in there about his strategy, right, in the Harper government, of sort of bringing immigrant communities into the fold, which was, again, very informative for my purpose, about how he made a conscious effort to, like, be in, you know, sort of quote-unquote ethnic media, to be a constant presence there, in sort of get the message out to conservative elements in these various ethno-cultural communities that the conservative party isn't anti-immigrant, that we actually share a lot of your values. And he was successful in doing that, right? I mean, the reason Harper got a majority was in large part due to Kenny's tireless efforts in these suburban ridings in the GTA and the greater Vancouver area, where there are lots of immigrants. And that was a big part of the sort of Harper majority strategy, because they realized, right, Mulroney's coalition, which was you know, sort of soft Quebec nationalists, big city business elites, and then Western Canadian populace, the new Conservative Party, right, the Reform and PC merger, the Quebec nationalists weren't interested in what they were selling, right? Because their sort of fiscal conservatism, this full-throated embrace of neoliberalism, even beyond what Brian Mulroney was proposing, didn't jibe with soft Quebec nationalists. So it was like, okay, what's that third leg for our stool to stand on? And Kenny was like, immigrants. We need
we need to extend the benefits of Anglo-Canadian white supremacy to a select group of immigrants of the right, exactly. who could put us over the top.
Right, exactly.
That was an excerpt from a new episode of The Progress Report. Find the archives, including more than 130 episodes, at progressreport.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, and wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Up next. Broadcasting since 2020, The End of Sport provides commentary, analysis, and interviews reimagining sport society and sporting cultures with academics Derek Silva in London, Joanna Mellis in Philadelphia, and Nathan Coleman Lamb in Fredericton. On this excerpt from a new episode featuring University of Connecticut panel discussion, Complicity and Solidarity, Sports, Higher Education, and Palestine, Israel, the hosts speak out against the genocidal violence being wrought against Gaza by the Israeli state with the full support of Canada and the U.S. Here's an excerpt from that episode.
Hi, friends, and welcome to a long, long, long overdue episode of the End of Sport podcast. My name is Nathan Coleman Lamb, and I am here with Joanna Mellis. Hi, Joanna.
Hey, everyone.
And Derek Silva. Hi, Derek.
Hey.
So you're not going to hear much from us today, and I'm going to explain why in a moment, but we are going to talk a little bit off the top. But before I get into the very serious subject matter of this episode, maybe just a couple of notes about the show in general, because you haven't heard from us in a long time, and that's not due to anything fundamentally significant on any of our ends, but just that we had really busy semesters in the fall that made it difficult for us to record, and so we were taking a little bit of a break after being much more consistent during the summer. But now we are back in earnest and intending to release episodes on the regular, hopefully weekly, for the foreseeable indefinite future. Who knows how long that lasts? You know, I don't want to make promises I can't keep, but we're planning. We've got many recordings already scheduled. We've made some recordings already, and we plan to do more. So it seems like hopefully for most of this semester, at least, we'll be able to keep the new audio content available for you. Now, because we have not been recording, that also means that we have really not spoken at all publicly through the venue of this podcast about the events in Palestine since October 7th. And it's incredibly important to us that the first episode we return with here on The End of Sport is one that addresses this subject directly, because the last thing we want to do is evade it. As far as we're concerned, really, there's nothing more significant to be speaking about. Again, the last thing we want to do is evade that. We want to kind of express to you where we are positioned on this topic as directly as possible. And we're going to do that in a moment. But I do want to say by way of introduction that what this episode will be today is a recording of a conversation conducted through UConn, the University of Connecticut, titled Complicity and Solidarity, Sport, Higher Education, and Palestine, Israel. And we are incredibly fortunate that the organizers of that event were willing to share this with us and to share it on End of Sport. And that conversation is going to speak for itself. So what you will hear today is that recording, pretty much in its entirety. And we're excited to share that with you. I think that's a great note for us to start with, a very serious conversation from people who have thought very seriously about this crucially important topic. What we're going to do in the remainder of the introduction here, however, is just to share a few of our own reflections. I'm sorry, I should also say that we have also scheduled an upcoming episode on this issue of Palestine, Gaza, and sport directly. Mm-hmm. That will be a more traditional End of Sport podcast episode, but we don't have that one recorded yet, so that's why we're not leading with it. We're leading with this one. So what I want to start by saying is, and I'm going to position myself directly here because I think it's important in terms of how I feel about this issue and what I think about it. It does relate to my own experience, my family's experiences. I am the descendant of Holocaust survivors, and that means that the history of genocide, genocidal violence, anti-Semitism is something that, you know, I take incredibly seriously and is indeed formative to me, to other members of my family. And the way I have always understood the concept of never again is that it does not apply to any one specific population. It's a universal kind of imperative that genocidal violence should never be tolerated in any context, again, under any circumstances. And for me, the circumstances that we have seen following October 7th with the unbelievably relentless bombing of Gaza by the government of Israel, the declarations by Israeli politicians, the denial of access to food, water, healthcare to those living in Gaza, the demand that those living in Gaza relocate if they want to survive. All of these events have the hallmarks of genocide. I felt confident saying that shortly after October 7th, quite frankly. And you know, I am on the editorial board now of the NB Media Co-op, and we published an editorial on October 16th, I believe it was, that said that what we were looking at was genocide already. And it has only worsened by many magnitudes since that point. And now, even more recently, we have confirmation from the International Court of Justice, who listened to South Africa's case that indeed a genocide is being perpetrated by Israel in Gaza. And the court has found that indeed there are very serious grounds to understand this as genocide, and they will hear the case more fully. And there's now a demand that that no acts that could be possibly construed as genocide occur in the coming month. And then immediately after that ruling came down, we learned that the United States and Canada, the European Union, are withdrawing funding from the UN RWA, the organization that has been doing the most of any to provide life-saving aid in Gaza. It's difficult for me to put into words how disgusted I am at the complicity of my own Canadian government in this genocide. I think complicity is actually not strong enough a word when we're thinking about arms dealing, when we're thinking about now refusing to provide aid, when we're thinking about basically gaslighting the ICJ, basically saying that the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, is not the legitimate arbiter of this issue because they're not saying what the Canadian government wants them to say. It leaves me almost speechless, but certainly it leaves me with a tremendous certainty that although we should have all known already that states founded on colonial violence that refuse to acknowledge the property rights of Indigenous people, despite the fact that in Canadian law, significant swaths of Canada belong to Indigenous people today.
Yeah.
Of course, there's no moral authority to the Canadian government, to the Canadian state, to the U.S. government, and so forth. But these events have absolutely underlined that point to the extent that I just feel profound shame and horror at my own position of complicity in this world system. And my heart breaks for all of those who have been subjected to this trauma in Palestine.
Yeah. And if I could just add a couple things, like obviously I agree with everything that Nathan is saying about this genocide. There's a couple things that I'd like to just briefly talk about in terms of my own past and my own work. I've been known as a sort of terrorism scholar, and this thing, this so-called notion of terrorism, has been thrown around, and I have been staunchly critical in approaches to or government responses to so-called terrorism, very much because they inevitably lead to genocidal artifacts, and that's kind of what we're seeing right here. And I'd just like to get on the record for the show that no act of violence, of so-called terrorism, single kind of act that we saw justifies the bombing of hospitals, the mass forced exodus of people from their homeland, the relentless bombing of streets, of houses, of schools, of universities. It simply does not exist. And that's the problem when we start talking about things through the lens of terrorism, that when it's said to be such, you can justify almost anything. And we're really seeing that in this particular context. And one of the things that I wanted to briefly mention is that we often in this space and in spaces in higher education, we talk about decolonization and we talk about the emergence, the evolution, the change of settler colonialism in various forms. And we talk about the answer to that as being this catchphrase kind of decolonization. We need to really heed the warning of Tuck and Yang here and not use decolonization as a metaphor, not engage in settler moves to innocence that disconnect or at least distract or sidestep the question of the repatriation of indigenous land and life. This is a moment in history where we need to not treat decolonization as a metaphor and think about the solution as being repatriation of indigenous land and life. And to all the folks who are out there every weekend, every week, seemingly across the streets of what seems to be the entire world, we on this show are with you. We are standing there in solidarity. We are out on those streets as well. We are projecting and amplifying the voices that we need to. So we would, I think we can all agree that we stand in solidarity with you and the work that you're doing.
That was a highlight from a new episode of The End of Sport. Find the more than 120 episode archives wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On a recent episode, Mount Royal University business prof Leah Hamilton explains why government and media coverage of the new international student cap incorrectly blames them for Canada's housing and healthcare crisis. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Red Eye. I'm Jane Williams. On the podcast today, I speak with Leah Hamilton about the new cap on international students and efforts to scapegoat them for Canada's housing and healthcare woes. A couple of weeks ago, Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada announced a new cap on the numbers of international students coming to Canada. The IRCC says it aims to issue 360,000 study permits this year, which is a 35% reduction over last year. This follows a doubling of the cost of living requirement for every province except Quebec, meaning that international students will have to demonstrate that they have access to more than $20,000. While it's clear that students need to be protected from predatory private colleges and unethical recruiters, the current media coverage of the cap, which blames students for Canada's housing and healthcare woes, is inaccurate and harmful, according to a recent article by Leah Hamilton and Yvonne Sue. Leah Hamilton joins me this morning. She is professor of organizational behavior in the Faculty of Business and Communication Studies at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Hello, Leah.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me today.
It's great that you could join me today. What reason does the government give for putting this cap in place?
When you look at the press release that IRCC released, they use the language of the integrity of the international student system being threatened. So IRCC talks about how institutions have really increased their intake of international students in order to drive revenue, and that students are arriving, they're not getting the supports they need to succeed in school or in their lives more broadly. And IRCC also says that rapid increases in the number of international students arriving in Canada puts pressure on housing and healthcare. The press release also mentions that they want to protect international students from bad actors. And when they say bad actors, they mean here predatory recruiters and private colleges.
So the media, I guess, latched on to the cap being somehow related to Canada's housing crisis. Is that fair to say that international students are contributing to Canada's housing crisis?
So we saw the media start to scapegoat international students for Canada's housing crisis back in September. And as Yvonne Sue and I argue in that piece in The Conversation, this is neither accurate nor fair. It's really overly simplistic and it's untrue. When you look at Canada's housing availability and affordability crisis, you know, this is something that has been decades long in the making. When you turn to housing experts, they argue that this housing bubble was caused by of a confluence of factors. So that would include municipal, provincial, territorial, and federal government policies. It includes municipal zoning laws, developers' interests, central bank policies. And I think what's interesting is if you look at past press releases that the immigration minister, Mark Miller, has released, in the past, he argued immigrants are actually key to solving the housing crisis because they bring skilled labor into the country. But now what we're seeing both in IRCC's press release and the media coverage of this cap is that there's a lot of scapegoating of immigrants and of international students. And I think this mixed messaging can really confuse the public. I think too that by overly focusing on demand for housing and scapegoating immigrants and international students, the government is drawing attention away from the things that it could take quite immediately to increase supply, such as really quickly and predictably approving developments that actually meet municipal zoning laws so that more affordable housing, and that includes rentals as well, can be built quickly and can be built near transit and other things. We can also do things like revisiting our policies on multi-home purchases. So these have absolutely surged since 2015. There's also evidence that the large majority of international students can't afford to compete with Canadians for homes or for rentals. So for instance, at York University, Professor Tanya Desgupta, her research on Punjabi international students has found that many students can actually only afford to spend a few hundred dollars a month on rent. So these are not the students that are competing for rentals or for buying homes.
Another angle that we see in the reporting of this cap is that it's going to have financial consequences for public post-secondary institutions where these students represent like a major revenue source. What's missing from this framing?
That's right. Yeah, I think we need provincial and territorial governments to better fund public education. So from coast to coast, you know, many public post-secondary institutions are facing significant financial sustainability challenges. You all have seen the headlines in recent weeks and months. Essentially, what's happened is that student enrollment has grown a lot over the past decade, but federal funding has remained stagnant. And so essentially what's happened was these public post-secondary institutions, because they have not received enough funding from the provincial government, they've viewed international students as a really important revenue source. And so where I think there's some issues with the way the media is covering this issue is that these stories have really focused on how the policy will have a dire impact on the financial sustainability of universities and how, you know, this might adversely affect Canadian students because domestic tuition rates will have to increase. But international students themselves have been really missing from this framing.
So they're basically just being seen as ways for post-secondary institutions to make ends meet rather than thinking about how it impacts them?
That's right. And I think, yeah, they haven't in many instances really considered the impact on international students themselves. And so post-secondary institutions have reacted to this cap in interesting ways. And an article actually was released this morning that was written by Universities Canada. So this is an organization that represents 234 post-secondary institutions across the country. And they wrote a letter addressed to Minister Miller where they expressed serious concerns about the cap. And they also, when you dig into the letter, it kind of suggests that IRCC didn't effectively consult with the post-secondary sector when they created this policy. And what Universities Canada argues is that faced with this uncertainty that's now been created in Canada, these students and future students are going to choose alternative destinations. And this will pose a significant risk to the post-secondary sector here in Canada. And it will potentially hinder our efforts to attract global talent for many, many years in the future. They also talk about how this won't only impact universities, but it will affect Canadian communities more broadly. International students contribute over $22 billion a year to Canada. And so this often sustains local labor markets. And so this policy extends far beyond institutions and will affect a lot of businesses and communities.
Do you think post-secondary institutions have been doing enough to help the students who do come?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll focus on the public post-secondary institutions because I have other comments about the private colleges. But I think it really depends. Some are already doing a lot. So there was an article in the Vancouver Sun recently where Thompson Rivers University explains how committed they are to international students. And they talk about the comprehensive sort of suite of services that they offer in trying to address academic, cultural, and personal needs of international students. So for example, at TRU, each student's assigned a dedicated international student advisor. And these people help with immigration, with academics, with well-being, mental health, assisting even with housing and so on. But other universities don't do enough. And I think universities need to think carefully about addressing students' needs broadly defined. So housing, food, cultural and personal needs, academic needs, and so on.
And what about private post-secondary institutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think in large part, one of the primary goals of this cap is to prevent exploitation by predatory private colleges. And we've already seen British Columbia and Ontario vow to crack down quickly on these private post-secondary institutions that are accused of exploiting international students. And, you know, in BC, the Minister of Post-Secondary Education and Future Skills, Selena Robinson, has already said that BC will pause any approvals for new post-secondary institutions that are looking to enroll international students. And that pause will take place all the way until February of 2026. So that's a 2-year pause. She's also indicated that fairly immediately, private institutions across BC will face more frequent inspections, that they will be increasing approval standards for degrees, that there'll be minimum language requirements, and so on. So I think that provinces are quickly going to try to get this predatory private college situation under control.
I want to go back to the IRCC news release of January 22nd for a moment. It said that the rapid increase in the number of international students, they talk not only about housing, but also about healthcare. Is there any basis for that statement?
I don't think so, no. I think, you know, most Canadians believe that the healthcare system has been in decline for more than a decade due to structural issues. And the College of Family Physicians of Canada, it's been sounding alarm bells about our healthcare system for years. They have been really publicly declaring that we need more family physicians. We know this. More than 6 million Canadians don't have a family doctor. I sort of dug into its most recent policy proposal package that tries to articulate, you know, what are the pressing needs for family doctors. And this policy package talks about higher remuneration. It talks about reduced administrative burden. International students or immigrants more broadly are not mentioned anywhere in that document. So I strongly believe that the federal government blaming international students for putting pressure on the healthcare system is a misrepresentation and an abdication of responsibility.
So on the one hand, we have a real problem, which is predatory colleges and unethical recruiters. So the cap is being put in place for that. But at the same time, the governments are making sort of these broad brush statements about housing and about healthcare. What are the social impacts when the government makes unsubstantiated statements like this about international students?
Yeah, I think in another article I wrote in The Conversation on January 7th, Keith Newman and I talk about how we're already seeing a shift in public attitudes toward newcomers here in Canada. So Environix, which every year conducts a public opinion survey, revealed this year that there's been a significant increase in the number of Canadians who believe that the country accepts too many immigrants. And this is a very dramatic reversal from a year ago. And what's interesting is when you dig into the data, this belief that immigration levels are too high is largely driven by perceptions that immigrants are contributing to the housing crisis. And so what's challenging here is that there is a large body of research that examines how perceived threat and competition predicts attitudes toward immigrants and immigration levels. And when there are perceptions of group competition over scarce resources, such as housing, for example, this can lead to negative attitudes. And essentially, when Environix collected their most recent data back in September of 2023, again, there was a lot of media coverage about the housing crisis. And we saw a lot of scapegoating of international students and immigrants. And so it seems that this type of coverage, this type of scapegoating, can harden some Canadians' attitudes toward immigration levels. I think we have to pay really close attention to this, because if Canadians continue to blame immigrants for the housing crisis, their attitudes toward immigrants themselves may harden. And if that happens, this will impact the type and level of supports immigrants and international students can access when they resettle, whether international students face discrimination in the housing and labor market, whether they're warmly welcomed by their communities, and so on.
So a whole lot of negative consequences from this mention in the government's press release.
I believe so, because it's not just the government that is doing this. It's also many media reports and representations of this cap.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me this morning, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.
I've been speaking with Leah Hamilton, Professor of Organizational Behavior in the Faculty of Business and Communication Studies at Mount Royal University. She is co-author with Yvonne Sue of an article that appeared in The Conversation Canada on January 25th.
That was Vancouver Co-op Radio's Red Eye. Find out more about the show at cooperadio.org and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. This episode of Harbinger Showcase has been brought to you by The Alberta Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertaadvantagepod.com. Subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for weekly updates on new episodes from Canada's cross-country community of more than 60 socially and politically progressive podcasts. Support our work for as little as $5 a month, and we'll send you a new release from Between the Lines Books or Fernwood Publishing. Find out more at harbingermedianetwork.com. Music on this episode is courtesy of Creative Commons and Jason Shaw. Stay tuned for another episode of Harbinger Showcase on this station next week. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Kalangola, CKUT Kalangola, 90.3 Angola, Kalang, Aile!
Jabu Uksa should be thought in the streets every time, you know?
What?
So I would say.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
De ton ami qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.